Today is Sunday. It's November 8th, 2020. This is a part 7 Grand Canyon oral history interview with Richard Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Hey, good afternoon, Richard. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Sure.
Thank you. We talked in part 7 about your river trips with Paul Winter and then the filming trip that happened. Is a series of 4 river trips that happened there. And you had mentioned something about the CIA in Grand Canyon. Can you open that up a little bit?
Yeah, it was... God, what year are we in? Early 80s?
Yeah.
And it was just one day I got a call, just a short story. I got a call from my boss. He said, meet him over at the Mule Barn. I said, no, yeah, no problem. Went over there. There was a couple of special forces guys and a couple of, I guess, were CIA. They were all, you know, they weren't in uniform. Special forces guys were. And they said that they were going to grab about 10 or 15 of our mules and take them down into the inner canyon and learn how to pack odd objects with them and just learn a little bit more about mules. And I'm, you know, we had probably 30 head, but taking 10 head or 12 head for a couple of weeks was really going to make us short. But excuse me. We didn't have any choice in the matter, basically. And so Dave Smith and I think Pete Howard, we showed him a few hitches, a barrel hitch, you know, just real simple hitches, and hauled the mules down to the Hermit, and they just disappeared down the trail, and we weren't allowed to go down there. They camped out down there for about a week. When they got back up, about 3 of them were kind of lamed. I mean, nothing where you had to put them down or anything, and we brought him back, and I never saw those guys again. And then I'm sure it was because they were heading into Afghanistan. It was about the same time as the Russians had invaded, I guess. But they were learning how to pack mules because they were definitely going somewhere to use them. And so that was the CIA story. I just found it kind of interesting that they could come in and commandeer a bunch of government mules.
That just sounds so odd that they wouldn't have asked one or two of you to come along to help teach them how to pack, how to handle large animals.
I think probably they had a lesson before they came down. They were more into the terrain.
Okay.
That this was going to be the same kind of terrain that they would, where they'd be working. I'm sure they definitely knew how to ride. And they knew how to do some things.
Okay.
But they needed to get experience in that kind of terrain.
Okay.
And, I'm sure that was the deal.
Did they take feed with them?
Yeah. They stayed down in. They food, some feed, and you know, you've been in the canyon, man. There's really not a lot to eat in any one place.
No, not for a while there.
Yeah. Yeah, unless you're just a burrow, wandering burrow.
Yeah. But that means you get to move around from acreage to acreage looking for food. I don't know. Maybe they were doing that, but curious.
Yeah, they moved. I think, you know, when they got back, they were a lot more proficient in canyon country and rocky country than when they went in. So, but yeah, it was just a kind of a weird side deal there.
Yeah.
That, you know, that they could come in there and do that.
Very interesting. Yeah, well, I hope it served them well.
Yeah.
Wherever they were off to, so. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts about your time at Grand Canyon now, sort of looking back and
Yeah, like I say, I might have covered some of this before, but it was a job that I was put into where initially I just felt over my head. When I got down there from Idaho, you know, if I needed something for the mules, I just went to somebody and said, "Hey, I need some feed, and I need this, I need that." And I never had any employees under my wing or supervising. And when I got to Grand Canyon, it was, okay, well, you know, here's your budget, and if you need anything, you know, make sure. And they showed me all the pre-computer. So it was all these handwritten spreadsheets.
Wow.
If I needed something, then I was the one doing the ordering. I was the one supervising the crew, as little as it was. And it was a whole different scene, and it was a whole different job than what I was used to. But I got through it. I did a good job there. I expanded the trail crew from about 5 or 6 people to when I left 4 years later. I was most of them were seasonal, but I did have some permanent positions also that I was able to fill. And I expanded it to the mid-20s, 20 people.
Wow.
And I think a lot of that was Howard Chapman. When we got done with the Pipe Creek Wall and Bright Angel Rehab and all of that, I think they saw that the money that they had recommended to us had been well spent. And so when I came in for a request for yearly budgets, increases, they were usually granted. I'm proud of the way that we kind of got the Inner Canyon trail trips going, where we would go down for 21 days and like stop at Nankoweap, stop at Thunder, stop at a lot of places and have our archaeologists with us and get those places a little fixed up.
Yeah.
Most resource damage. So, yeah, when I left there, I'm proud of a lot of the friends I met there. When I went to Olympic, I had guys I had hired at Grand Canyon followed me up to Olympic after I'd been there for a year.
Oh, cool.
Inherited the same kind of scene at Olympic as I inherited at Grand Canyon.
Let's open that up. Was there any event or anything that sort of led you to leave Grand Canyon, or did you just see the job? How did that come about that you ended up going to Olympic National Park?
Well, I loved my time up in Idaho in the Northwest, and my brother had moved from San Diego to Seattle. Opened up a little sporting goods store there.
Oh, okay.
He had gotten married, and then my father had died, years before.
Right.
And my mother decided to make a move from the Bay Area in California on up to Seattle.
Okay.
And I just thought it might be nice to get the band back together again. That was a lot of my thinking with it. And I'd been to Olympic just on a couple of day trips, and it stuck in my mind. I remember sitting up on Hurricane Ridge going, wow, this would be a great place to work.
Hmm.
And so the job came open, and I applied for it.
Was that for, again, the head a trails foreman job?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
And I guess it was a pretty good cert, unlike the Grand Canyon. I think there was like two or three names on the cert at Grand Canyon, but it was a pretty good cert, but I got selected for it.
Did you get an interview? Did they take you up and interview you, or they just said, you got the job, come on up?
No, definitely interviews, and those kind of jobs they have protocol to, that they have to follow.
I see.
Job interviews with your supervisors and some of the people working with you and yada yada. I think I got the job up there is because Olympic, 7 or 8 years before, had decided that they were going to get rid of all their stock, all their mules, all their tack.
Wow.
And they realized, I think, that was a mistake. And I think I got the job because of my experience with the mules and the horses. They were talking about maybe trying to get a pack string going again there.
So when you arrived as a trails foreman, they had no mules or no horses?
Yeah.
Wow.
Had about seven people, no stock whatsoever. 600 miles of trail in the park.
Holy cow.
Some of the, if you could work trails in Olympic, I told people after I'd been there 4 or 5 years, you can do it anywhere.
Wow.
Had all kinds of, different topography and such, from coastal strip to alpine to glaciers to, temperate rainforests.
Wow.
Rivers and creeks and absolutely spectacular place.
How many acres, roughly?
I think it passed 1 million.
Wow.
A couple of additions.
It's as big as Grand Canyon, 1.1 million.
And no
pack animals. Wow, that's kind of hard
no
to
pack,
yeah. Sort of rock you back on your heels there and ponder that one.
I know. I was like, whoa. So, and six people. And I was known as the Mormon foreman because they figured if I was coming from Arizona, Utah, I had to be Mormon.
Okay.
But I got up there, good solid crew. good solid crew, but only six or seven of them. And again, every time you take a new job at a different national park, I think, you know, you need to just keep your mouth shut and observe for, you know, months before you can start going, well, we need to do this, we need to do that, we've got to do this. And that's the approach I've always taken. Until I got that, I've been doing it 20 years, I could kind of come into a place and go, yeah, we need to do this. But so the first year was, again, for me, a hell of a learning experience. There was opposition in the resource management division about bringing stock back to the park. They had decided that too much of a chance to bring exotics in, and you know, it was kind of a bogus argument, but there were some hardcore, you know, no, we've been doing it like this for the last 8 years, we don't need to chance of bring exotics in, and, you know, we're against having stock in the park, and yada yada. So I think it was about 4 or 5 months in, 6 months in, and at that time, you know, I could see, man, there was no way we were going to work 600 miles of trail in the Olympics without some support, you know, without a way to get tools and such in there.
Tools and basically, food and camp, yeah, supplies for spike camps, and wow.
Yep, exactly. Huh. And but the guys that I had, they were proud of their ability to go out. They're mostly local Port Angeles boys. They'd been running around the Olympics for years. And they were able to get out there. But an average deal would be like a 50, 60-pound pack, and then a chainsaw in your right arm carrying, and whatever else, and a Pulaski and a shovel in your other arm. And we would send them out in gangs of two, and basically all they were able to do was open the trails.
Right.
And what, we got 7 world record-sized trees in the Olympics, and thousands of others that are just, you know, just almost as big. And depending on the year, like say the whole rainforest, that's a pretty famous trail. It's on the west side of the park. Gets about 130, 140 inches of rain a year.
Wow.
Maybe less. It's the approach to climb Mount Olympus. But that trail probably runs flat through the river valley for about 10 or 12 miles, and then you start picking up elevation, and most of it all along the river, and deadfall everywhere. You go out there in the spring, and the opening crews would just work their way up the trail, and it was slow, it was cumbersome, they could do nothing else but open the trail, they couldn't do tread work, they couldn't do drainage work, the trails were a mess, So one day before a hitch started, a tour started, we had everything out in front of our little shop there in the maintenance compound. I went over and I got the superintendent, who was Bob Chandler, who later became superintendent of Grand Canyon, and who I had met the year before on a river trip in the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And we had gotten along really good on that river trip, which is amazing, because I met him, Crumbo and I had hiked in, I think I told you this, through Thunder River and hiked down to like Upset and that little beach on the left, and just hot and all day trip. When I went over and the boats were down, we could see the boats down there, got down, ran over to a boat, sat down, and started popping beers. And John Thomas came over to me and he said, hey, you made it. Yeah, and I looked up and on the beach and I said, who's that guy? And he said, that's Bob Chandler and his wife, Mitzi, and superintendent at Santa Monica. They're just kind of looking at me. And I said, oh, good. There's another superintendent that'll never hire me. Yeah. And we spent like 3 days on the river with him, and then we, Crumbo and I hiked out Lava. And but all of a sudden, Chandler's the superintendent at Olympic. And I went over, got Bob, and said, Bob, can you come over to the trail? Trailsville. He said, sure. And I have my 6-7 guys hanging around there, chainsaws, packs, everything, just, you know, ready to go out for 8 days. I said, Bob, pick up that pack right there. And he picks up this pack and he just goes, whoa, you know. I said, now pick up that chainsaw. And so I was making my point to him that we definitely needed some help. And so I just told him, I said, shit, you know, we need stock. We need some stock. He said, okay. How many you need? I said, well, let's just, you know, start small and work our way up. And he ran it through. He just said, okay, I'm tired of talking about this. We're going to do it. Resource people were a little pissed. And I was authorized to start with 6 head.
Wow.
And so we went down. Right at this time, I brought a lady from Grand Canyon down. I called her up, and this is the lady I'd met she was a YCC, Claire Donato. Turned out to be the first female packer in the, you should maybe call her.
Do you have contact information for her?
I do, yeah.
That'd be great. We'll talk about that. Yeah. I'll get that from you later.
But she, I said, Claire, got the okay to get a pack stream going here in the Olympics. You know, you want to come up and be a packer. And that's all she'd ever wanted.
Wow.
And so she left the canyon, drove on up, if you talk to her, she'll tell you the story about her, the first day she was in the Olympics.
Hmm. Cool.
And we drove, went over to North Cascades and borrowed a stock truck and something to pull it with.
That was the National Forest you borrowed it from?
National Park.
Okay.
North Cascades National Park.
Okay.
And and headed down to Santa Barbara to pick out 6 mules and haul them back up to the Olympics. And we were down there for a few days. Chamberlain was the guy, Chamberlain Mules. And picked out 6. And these are just halter broke, you know. I mean, that's it. They're halter broke. And I've always believed that you just want to kind of get your own young mule and do what you do with it, because you don't want somebody else's problems that maybe didn't do things like you would do them.
Hmm.
And we picked out 6 mules, hauled them up to Port Angeles, 2.5-day trip, and started breaking them and buying tack and riding them in the corral that we had to build. We built a corral and a friggin' barn. And shit, we were on our way. And they made a huge difference. Huge difference.
Rich,
and we just stuck to that.
Sorry, I got a question here. You mentioned you had a crew of six folks there.
Yeah.
Your trails crew that you had they worked around mules before?
No.
Okay, no. So not only did you have to train the mules, but you had to train your crew.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. Yep. And this was happening midway through the first year I was there, I guess, when we picked up the mules.
This is 83 or 84?
85? Yeah, I think 80. I got to look at my arrowhead again. It's got the dates I was in different parks.
Okay.
Yeah, this would have been probably the spring of 84.
Okay.
Claire would have known better than I, But brought him out and worked him for a good month in the corral, and then started taking him on little day rides and teaching him how to ford creek. Started with little creeks and then rivers and got a good working string. And then I just kept adding to that initial 6. Every year I would budget in for 3 or 4 mules. And we ended up, 26 or 27 when I left.
Wow.
Bigger yet. But there's such a key to, and one of the deals is we ended up packing more for resource management folks. guys going in to study fishers or guys going in to do fisheries or whatever. And we just reached out and said, listen, I've got a crew going up the Elwha to Elkhorn. If you guys need some food, equipment, or anything packed in, just have it at the barn by such and such a time. And that's how we started with it. And then it was like more formal requests from resources than just about anybody else.
Wow. Yeah, well, absolutely. It's the same in Grand Canyon as well. You use the river as a way to get through a lot of the park for
right.
the science center, for resource folks looking
yep.
at looking at this and that, as well as the trails.
Yep.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it was a great move for me. And unlike Grand Canyon, where I, when I first got there thinking, shit, I'm over my head in this job and stuff, I was able to kind of hit the ground there in the Olympics. And like I say, I would keep my mouth shut, listen to the crew. And it was probably 6 or 7 months before we got permission for the mules. And once we got that done, it just made my job so much easier. And the second year I was there, I had a Hopi boy from the canyon come up, Mike Tomici, another guy by the name of Pat Horning, and Claire, and a couple others came up. And, you know, like for Tomici, Mike Tomici, he'd never been off. He was a second Mesa boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he lasted 2 years, and he just came and said, yeah, I got to get home and miss the dances. And I said, yeah, I understand that, man. But he said it was just such a great experience for me up here. And I've always been a diversity kind of guy. So when I started expanding the crew at Olympic, too, I really reached out to a lot of the tribes that were on the Olympic Peninsula.
Cool.
Macaws, Lapush, Queets, lots of little tribes up there, Jamestown. And so I had a, well, most diverse crew in the park, that's for sure. I mean, no doubt about it. Port Angeles, park headquarters, very conservative town, starting to get a little more together. Beautiful place, real conservative, but and 99% white, you know.
Yeah.
And so you go ahead and try to make a, do whatever you can, you know. To maybe involve other people. But yeah, it was a great park. Unbelievable park.
Did the crew, I mean, clearly your crew before the first mule showed up were some very strong people.
Yes.
Did they cotton on really quick to the increased capacity basically that they were able to pack? And therefore increase their range in the field. Did they, I'm assuming they would have clicked into that like on day one.
Well, they didn't. Like I say, they were basically out of the six that I inherited within the first 13 or 14 months. And it was similar to the Grand Canyon. It was they were reassigned to different parts of the park.
Okay.
Different jobs. Because the foreman that I replaced there had been a local boy, born and raised. And I went back and looked and talked to the old timers and stuff. I was the first trail foreman in Olympic National Park that wasn't born and raised on the peninsula.
Wow.
So that would tell you something. It was always, before it had always been filled by, okay, Riom has been working here for 13 years. It's his turn. And then Riom retired, and it's Warder's turn. And so that caused one of the guys on the crew had applied for the foreman's job too.
Hmm.
And when I got it, he was crushed, and he never really never did anything to help me. And I had to finally tell him, hey, I'm not expecting your help, but just stay out of my way.
Right.
And so he was reassigned. Another lady, Kathy, was reassigned. So I lost half my crew. And then, which was good. Then I replaced him with people that I'd known and worked for. And you know, Claire came up from the canyon and did just a magnificent job with the helping me start that pack string. And, so, yeah, no, they didn't take to it right off the get-go, but, you know, by year two, everybody was just friggin' excited, but then you had to tell them, hey, man, one case of beer a guy. You know, they'd show up the barn and all this shit, and it's not, you know? But,
You know, Richard, let's stop here for a minute and ask you about this. You pack in a bunch of people, or a small handful of people, for a week or two. They're clearly not on the clock 24 hours a day. And so they want to bring in what they would normally drink or normally do to recreate for their off hours in a normal 9-to-5 job. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, we definitely came to the point where we had to put limits, especially if we were doing like on the opening cruise. I increased the opening crew size when I finally started getting more people there. From used to be two people heading up a river valley. And I increased those to four, so they could cut the trees, they could do tread work, they could brush the trails, they could do this, they could do that. But we did definitely have to put some limits on how much alcohol, how much this, how much of that, and most of them were really good about. You know, only bringing one change of clothes, say, and leaving a pair in the rig for when they got out, they could friggin' change into dry stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, tents, we were able to say, okay, everybody can have their own tub. But they still had heavy packs. It's not like they walked up the trail with a day pack with 10 pounds in it. So they still had some pretty heavy packs, and when they were going into camp, they were taking trails or taking tools and that kind of stuff. And then we would maybe work 5 miles up a river valley. That's all the farther we'd get that week. And so then the next week, everything was packed that 5 miles in, and they would work out of there to 9 miles up the valley, and then the next time we would pack in 9 miles, and that's how we progressed up these valleys. And they would work in front of the mules most of the time and get the trail cleared, and then we could roll in with the pack string.
Right.
But we had some major bridge jobs that we did up there that we'd have two or three packers going to the same place with 12 mules, you know,
wow.
On a bridge job, had a crew of six or seven working at the same place. And there was shelters up there that had been built. And a lot of times it's possible when we try to camp at a shelter, there was backcountry ranger stations that we would use to make things, you know, better. You'd go into a place that already had pots and pans in it, had a wood stove and a couple of bunks, you know. So,
were you using helicopters for resupply at all?
not necessarily resupply of the crews, but for, we did a lot of, like I said, bridge work. I got into a deal with the military over in Tacoma. They would come over and do training exercises in their Chinooks, and we could use those guys for free, and they would fly like big bridge stringers and that kind of stuff, and we had a little Hughes 500 on contract that that could bring us in incidentals, but no, helicopter flying was, I won't say frowned upon, but it was, if there's no way else to get it in there, okay, you can use it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it wasn't a routine thing like when I got the volcano, you know, if you're going 7 miles, man, call the friggin' helicopter and go helicopter beach camping for a week, you know. Camp like I've never camped in my life. But yeah. So
what kind of bridge spans were you making? How far were you spanning?
Oh fuck. The biggest was probably 110 feet.
Whoa, so that would need a couple of center pillars along the way, or was that one span?
A couple of them were one span.
Wow.
First one I ever worked on was a place called Graves Creek, and that was 90 some odd feet, and originally, and I didn't like this, is we were using native materials. Like I say, it's home to 7 world class trees, and we would take down usually big fir for the stringers.
Okay.
And then learn how to yard those things across, and you take down a cedar or find a dead cedar for the deck and the handrails. You could be on a job like that for months.
Yeah, I mean just getting an 80 foot long, you know, fir across the creek and into position.
Yep.
That's a huge amount of work right there.
Yep.
Then you've got to do it again for the next one, and then you've got to deck the thing and then put on some railings, and that's just huge.
That's huge. It's huge. We built a 60-footer, 65-footer, 17 miles into the backcountry.
Well.
And that was the first big job for the original six mules. And they learned a lot on that.
It would take you, how many days would it? How many days would it take to pack in there? 75 miles.
No, not 75, 17.
Oh, 17, I'm sorry.
17, and we'd do it in a day.
Okay.
To gear up, a lot of times during, the crew would be out there 8 days, 8 to 6. And depending on the job and stuff, there would be times where we might go up that valley 2 or 3 times.
Huh.
So you go in 17, you get up in the morning, you pack out the shit from the tour before, all the garbage and all the other stuff and all the tools that were broke, go back down to the trailhead and drop all that shit, pick up another load, and come back in on the third day.
Wow.
So yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was fun. It was, I was able to, it was more like Idaho. You know, I was in the saddle a lot. I had a couple other packers. And I don't know how many thousands of miles I friggin' rode up there. But
did you have an office person to help you with budgets and that kind of stuff, purchasing and keeping supplies going?
I did. We actually, there was a secretary that took care of the road foreman and myself. You know, I spent a lot of time doing it, especially in the early years when I was building it up. But it was the kind of deal where I liked to be out in the field. And if I had to go in on a day off or something to take care of all that shit, then, you know, I was fine with it, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, then I met a woman and fell in love, made the big Park Service mistake of marrying a local girl, you know.
Okay.
Fuck. Not a mistake, I know. Scratch that. It wasn't a mistake at all. It was the best move I ever made. But, and so then I kind of realized that, okay, I'm here, you know. This is where I'm going to work. And I never regretted it. I had, I think it was 1991. I would have been, at Olympic for 7 years, 6 or 7 years. And things were rolling pretty good. And I got selected to go to Facility Managers Development Training, I guess it was the formal name for it. And it was going to be 3 months at Albright, which I was kind of looking forward to, you know, go stay at Albright, and you go to class every friggin' day, and then you go to... Well, I got, after that 3 months, I got sent to Washington, D.C.
Whoa. That's a change. Gee.
That's a change, bro.
Okay, so the facilities management development training, what was the concept of the training?
The concept was to train the new up-and-coming managers of the National Park Service. That they're going to spend a lot of time and a lot of money training you guys. And that's what it was, too. I think there was 18 of us in the class. And we were all white boys. I think there was one female in the class.
Wow.
And that was the concept. And it was, you know, I have a hard time sitting still, so that 3 months at Albright was like, God damn. But they would go through diversity. They would go through public health kind of stuff. They would definitely a big deal on supervision. And just everything that a park manager friggin' needed to learn, you know.
And
then the assignment...
They didn't give you this training before you took the job, which sounds...
Olympic.
Yeah, well, yeah, it sounds like this would all be good stuff to know before you took the job.
Well, this was going to be what they're teaching you is what basically as a supervisor and doing that, I was mid-level management. You consider that mid-level.
Yeah.
This was going to be for managed. This was management training.
Okay, as in chief of maintenance kind of positions.
Chief of maintenance, future superintendent.
Got it.
You know, all of that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And I don't know how the fuck I was selected for that.
Who was the superintendent at Olympic at the time? Was Chandler still there?
Yeah, I think Chandler was still there.
So do you think he had something to do with that?
Might have been Marine Center. Now, Chandler was there because while I was at Albright, then he left to go to the Everglades.
Huh.
And then a lady by the name of Maureen Finnerty came in as superintendent.
How do you spell Maureen's last name?
I don't know. Finnerty. You'd spell it better than I would.
Okay. Finnerty. And she came in as the new superintendent at Olympic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I remember doing a video for her because I wasn't going to be around. I was going to be at Albright, and I was doing this other stuff. And my friggin', I wish I had that video.
Mm.
My goal was to try to get their ear, so I made this probably half-hour video of some of the problems we had at Olympic and what we were doing and what the needs of the trails were there. And I did it all out on different trails. I my cameraman was a well-known poet environmentalist by the name of Tim McNulty.
Huh.
And we went around and I shipped that off to her. And when I first met her after being gone I was 3 months at Albright. I was gone for like 5 months. When I got back, the first time I met her, she says, "Oh, I know you, man. I watched your video 3 times," and then she started laughing, you know. But now I'm getting a little turned around on time.
Okay, let's go back. So the facilities management development training for 3 months at Albright. Then it must have followed on after the training with a workplace kind of job site, on the job training, if you will. Does that make sense as to how you ended up in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Exactly right. And that was an eye opener.
So D.C., I mean, we're talking about like marble statues and lots of grass. Way different than trails. What?
Yeah.
You know, before we go there.
it's a good place to wrap it, you know.
Okay, yeah, because I want to know a little bit more about Albright and what you saw was going down at Grand Canyon when you came back after being away for a while. Cool.
Yeah, and then, you know, then I had my eyes opened in D.C., this would be a good place to pick it up next time and start on that, you know.
Awesome. Let's do that. Well, hold on a minute, and this will conclude part 7, oral history interview with Richard Hansen. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Sunday, November 8th, 2020. And Richard, thank you so very much.
Yeah, thank you. This has been fun and makes me think and remember and you know.
Cool.
So, yeah, that's good. So yeah, we can pick it up and
cool. All right, hang on a second.